Castles and coffins, bloodlust and bats. Vampire stories have been around for ages and in many different cultures across the globe. But the draining of life doesn't always involve nibbles on the neck from mysterious strangers. Sometimes there are no bites, and the vampires may be closer than you think. Welcome to You Totally Made That Up, a history podcast that tells you the wildest, craziest, nuttiest stories from yesteryear, ones that sound like somebody must have totally made them up. But they're all true, and we especially like the ones that have supernatural, paranormal, woo-woo elements, so those parts may only be true to the people who live them. We don't go for the lore says or the legend goes, though. We want dates and names and all the facts we can find. Basically, we like the weirdest and strangest stories from history. We are not historians, we are merely researching and presenting you said stories in a delightful way. This is also not a podcast where the hosts simply read from Wikipedia and giggle. If that is your jam, this show is not for you, but please do give it a go anyhow. Don't forget to keep listening after the episode's over to hear the outro, which will tell you how to get hold of us, where to find us on social media, and it is a delight to hear from you. And if you would be so kind, please take a moment to leave the show a rating or review on your platform of choice. That is more helpful than you know, and thank you so much to all of you who have already done so. It is much appreciated. My name is Nash, and I am your host. I'm usually joined by co-host Tiff, but she is presently on hiatus, so in coming episodes, I will be wrangling up a variety of people to come listen to me tell a story. There won't be two stories for now. Hope y'all don't mind that too much. And so today, I'm joined by a buddy of mine, Phil.
Hello.
That's Phil.
That's all I have.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I was completely taken aback by how you locked right in there. I felt like I was listening to the podcast. I wasn't prepared.
They're probably so tired of that same ass intro every time. But you know what? There might be new people. You never can tell.
No, it locked me right in. I was ready. I was ready to listen to an episode. I forgot I was here.
Well. As y'all have seen in the episode description and heard in the intro, this go-round, we're talking vampires, but we can't fully go down the road of the history of this lore. We'd be here for days. And by the way, I am still in the midst of the torrent of oral surgery that has stretched over a year. And of course, I picked a topic with a V, so if I'm overemphasizing it, that's because I'm trying to get around my mushy mouth. And your name is Phil. And so there's the F's. I have trouble with F's and V's. So it just, everything's working out great today. So in the episode about Bram Stoker and Dracula, Tiff did touch on this topic. So go check that out if you want a basic rundown. What you need to know for our present story is that there is evidence across time and across various groups of people in various locations that they believe the dead would rise and sometimes come after the living. And this definitely overlaps with concepts such as zombies or revenants. And corpses have been found in weird states. We'll cover an example of that here in a bit. But archaeologists have found things like beheadings and dismemberments to prevent the dead from rising and being able to use their body, and posts or spears or stakes driven through the corpse to essentially pin them down and keep them in the grave. So there was definite fear and superstition going way back. This is somewhat rare to find, but it's certainly nothing new. Okay, another thing to recall is that the portrayal of modern-day vampires, Tiff also touched on this, they are hell and gone from what the vampire concept began as, namely that they were gross, not seductive, not charming, not morphing from the gross to the gorgeous, none of that. But one thing in common with the vampires we'll be talking about today is that sometimes they were quite familiar to those they were supposedly going after. Just not like a sparkly high school boyfriend.
All right.
Now, as y'all know, I often like to set the scene before the story gets cranking to get you primed, get your brains grooving down a certain path. And in this instance, I want to quickly review for you some of the progress our lovely human race had made in the realm of scientific advancement by the time of our story. Well, in ingenuity and invention, stuff like that, the big things that had advanced society. And go on and mark the 1800s on your bingo card, because that's where we'll be heading shortly. Because, you know, the 1800s, that's where shit hit the fan, and there's lots and lots of material. Our main story is in the 1890s, so that's our cutoff for this rundown. First off, there's the things you already know that have been around since God was a boy, like the shift from astrology being a science to know astronomy is what's the science, and the telescope, and various mathematics, and I mean, things like domestication of horses, and how to rotate crops, and rudimentary sewer systems, and stuff of that ilk. I'm not talking about those things. The things that can be traced back to medieval times, and the Bronze Age, and the Iron Age, and the BC years. Y'all already know all that. So by the late 1800s, a few odds and ends. Here goes. Deep breath. We had barometers, thermometers, pendulum clocks, pianos, water pumps, piston engines, steam engines, internal combustion engines, various mechanical contraptions such as sewing machines and calculators and looms and air compressors and threshers, machines for making paper, and then later a powered printing press. There's cameras, guns, then more advanced guns, lawnmowers, electric motors, telegraphs, matches and lighters, fertilizer, cement, how to make steel, ice makers, a practical refrigerating machine, plastics, synthetic dyes, rechargeable batteries, pasteurization of milk, electric generators, the phonograph, the telephone, gas-powered car, gas-powered lights, wind turbines. I am stopping now.
Wow.
Wow, a lot. I was shocked that there was that amount of modern things that have really, if you think about it, not evolved too terribly much to present day. I was shocked that that was all by the late 1800s.
I wish I could have heard all of it, but I was just lulled into a complete sense of the Industrial Revolution. I tuned out after the third. I felt the combustion happening around me.
I'm glad you're adequately combusted. And while not everybody had access to all this, while not all of it was in mass production or something, the knowledge was out there. Newspapers existed, and people knew about this stuff for the most part, unless they were living in proverbial caves or up proverbial trees. I mean, if you were in a town or a city, you at least had an inkling of it. As a matter of fact, the Associated Press was founded in New York City in May of 1846. And yes, it started with five local newspapers, but those big newspapers would be referenced and or quoted in smaller publications in that area, if not many other areas in the country. And this area happened to be the Northeast. I mentioned the Northeast for a reason. So let's shift to advances in medical science, and in particular, infectious disease. The first draft of this, I went on a tear telling you about the history of infectious disease identification and all of that, but luckily I got some sleep. And I came to my senses, and I realized it would have bored you all to death and made this episode a gajillion hours long, and my lovely guest would have run for the hills. Instead, here's the skinny on medical advancement as it relates to tuberculosis, aka TB, specifically, and I'll put a bunch of stuff in show notes if you want to read more. And yep, you can mark off our favorite disease on your bingo cards as well, and get ready. Hoo boy. Because I know you haven't listened to our entire catalog, but tuberculosis is following us. It has come up in many, and it really has. It's come up in many an episode.
Haunted by the everlasting presence of tuberculosis.
That's us.
Yeah, no, you're really good at this. I just, every time you start talking, I just start listening because I've listened to a ton of it.
Oh.
Like, for the last 2 weeks, I have an hour before I have to do, like, real work when I get to work, so I've just always knocked out an episode before I go out to the floor. And it's so impressive that, like, you're, I don't know, I've never been here for this, like, you're just locked right in. It's amazing.
You're an angel, and thank you, and he's not being paid, everybody. He's not. He's not. We're keeping it a secret. He has a secret identity online. And, you know, now that you've mentioned you and your buddy, who I also know, are thinking about a podcast, I'm probably gonna peer pressure you into it. We'll see. I think you do great online, so.
Well, thank you.
He's a good host. He's got a secret Twitch channel, so if you guys can find it, best of luck. See if you can find it. You'll recognize his voice. I think you got a very distinctive voice.
I don't know how I feel about that.
You do. It's a good distinctive voice.
Okay, I'll take that. Please, more compliments.
More compliments. And you guys, hey, you got to make sure and compliment him.
Oh, I was kidding.
Now I'm peer pressuring the audience. No, I love compliments, so I'm happy to dish them out. By the point of our main story, Germ theory was out there since the 1860s when Louis Pasteur broke it all down, and the basics on it are simply them saying that there's these little boogers we scientists have seen under the microscope. The commonality is we're detecting them in diseased people and animals, and they're each unique, but when compared to said people and animals with similar symptoms, they match up. So on the metaphorical giant pin board of diseases, lots of strings are getting tied, connecting certain microbial samples to certain infections. Now, they hadn't yet quite differentiated between viruses and bacteria. Quick recap for those of you who either don't know or have forgotten. Bacteria we can kill because bacteria are independent contractors. They have their own resources for survival. We can typically knock them out with antibiotics, and examples would include strep throat and UTIs. Viruses are full-time employees. They need a host to survive, and that host is you. Because it invades your cells and is basically using your energy or whatever you want to call it to supply them, they are hard to shake off and are more apt to jump from person to person. And they will learn as they go, mutating to be more effective on their invasion mission. So unless you shut down transmission so they don't get any more practice runs, it only gets worse. That's not to say that certain bacteria can't be highly contagious too. They can be. I mean, hello, TB. And hey, there's bacterial and viral versions of some diseases, such as pneumonia or meningitis. But look, we're starting to get into the weeds big time. What I'm trying to get at is they're not the same. They can produce very similar symptoms in you, but the mechanism is different. Ergo, the treatment has to be as well. And we don't have cures for viruses. There are antivirals to help stamp down continuing reproduction once identified, but those don't kill like antibiotics can kill bacterial infections. So, from the common cold to AIDS, we can't cure viruses as of now. Best we can do is get ahead of the game with vaccines, and for some issues, there's just not vaccines as of yet. And of course, all the while, there was plenty of documentation on how various diseases progressed and outcomes and such. Understanding of the human body was growing. We've talked about the anatomist, that whole dissection thing in past episodes. Things like the humors and miasma and phrenology and spontaneous generation. We've talked about some of that before too. Those concepts are gradually getting dropped to the side. And on top of all this, medication is being discovered, and medication that was being used already was reconsidered with more discerning eyes and kind of dug into in the sense of, okay, the plant foxglove seems to have impact on the heart, but what exactly is it doing? How does it work? And today we call it digitalis. It is sometimes still used and prescribed. But the virus angle, the vaccination angle, really grew rapidly. Antibiotics for bacterial infections were still a long ways off, and I suspect the reason is because, used to, vaccinations contain live virus, and it was introduced in a small amount to a well person to teach their immune system what it was, and that way, if it ever encountered the bug, the immune system would quickly and aggressively mount an attack. It would recognize it and know what to do. So what I'm trying to say is they had the material available to them with which to work. It wasn't, they weren't having to invent something from scratch or stumble upon it, a la penicillin. Antibiotics, different beast, so I'm not going to get into that for time reasons. Because speaking of penicillin, it comes up in the 1920s, and I didn't realize personally, I either didn't know or forgot that it was that recent. In my mind, penicillin's been around for forever. The thing with antibiotics is that they contain little killers that target the bacteria bugs. They can make them explode. Sometimes they root around inside of them. It's great. Like I say, though, nobody knew the difference. Disease was disease. But the point is, a bunch of stuff starts rolling out, beginning with the smallpox vaccine in 1796 in Europe, and it gets introduced to the U.S. in 1799. Then naturally, as vaccines do, when enough of the population receives them, rates of infection and death start going down, blah, blah, blah. Y'all know this. It takes time. On the other hand, this isn't happening on Mars or something. It can be witnessed, and of course, it makes news. From 1879 till 1890, courtesy of numerous scientists, vaccines and treatments for cholera, anthrax, rabies, tetanus, diphtheria roll out. Look those up on your own. All very deadly. Not great to die from any of them. Painful, laborious, dare I say gruesome in some instances. But they're slowly starting to fade. Mortality is improving, and it's starting to give the general impression that there should be cures for stuff, which is not true, that there is cures for everything and scientists are just holding back or something. But people started to look at it as, oh, it's just in a little bit, they're going to roll out a cure for blah, blah, blah. Not the case. Then we have one Robert, and I'm going to struggle with this. It's spelled K-O-C-H, German, and it's pronounced close to cough, except all phlegmy, and I'm not going to do that to y'all, so I'll just say cough. And the other option, I guess, is cock. So which should I go with?
I mean, all signs point to cock at all times.
All right, we're going with cock. In any event, he is mega impressive. He discovered the causes of many diseases, including the aforementioned cholera, anthrax, and also tuberculosis. And he is considered one of the main founders of modern bacteriology. He ultimately receives a Nobel Prize. Our new friend Koch was particularly interested in TB, and for good cause. It was wreaking havoc, and I'll tell you how much in just a second. TB had been identified in 1834 by another German, a pathologist, Johann Schonlein, and he named it tuberculosis because when he performed autopsies, he saw these lesions internally, typically in the lungs, and the lesions were called tubercules. Tubercules? Tubercules. We'll go with that. I have to pause here. My source, it actually said post-mortem autopsies, and it really made me laugh because, yes, that's what autopsy is. They get done when you're dead. You can't have an anti-mortem autopsy. You can't dissect someone when they're alive. That's called murder. We haven't fully talked about TB before, and I'm not going to go into it extensively, but for our story, you do need to know what this looks like, what this does to people, so time out for a second while we do that. There are two primary forms, active and latent. When it's active, it mostly attacks the lungs, as said, so your breathing gets really ragged and you're coughing constantly and coughing up the junky mucus and often ultimately blood. It can go to other organs and damage them and can also get into your bones and joints. You would get superty-duperty pale, and so TB was nicknamed the White Death or the White Plague because of this. You, of course, have a high fever that waxes and wanes, you're sweating profusely, and because your body is doing all this work between your immune system trying to fight it and the constant activity of coughing, and then add in lack of appetite, you drop weight like crazy, and that's how it got its most well-known nickname, consumption, because it seemed to people that whatever this was, it was literally consuming them alive. When it's latent, you don't show symptoms and you don't spread it to others. This is the form that most people have. In other words, any of us could have it and never know it unless we're tested for it. And I happen to have been. By nature of my job as a clinician, it was required because 10% of latent carriers can convert to active, and if so, then can spread it. I don't have TB, by the way, in case anybody cares. I have brought up the two different categories for a reason. As with everything I bring up, there is always a reason. Hang on every damn word I have to say. So, how do it get around? Well, it's airborne. As said, most common form is in the lungs. That's where it most often starts. So when the infected cough and talk and sneeze and laugh or whatever, boom goes the dynamite. If you're in close quarters for long periods of time, obviously a greater chance. And it's highly contagious, only takes a little exposure. I've got a World Health Organization article in the show notes for you with lots of lovely statistics. But it's treatable, it's curable. Yes, there's some drug-resistant issues, as there are with practically all bacterial diseases nowadays, but we have the capability of getting after it. So, back to Koch. Not, you know, the guy, the scientist. Okay. In the early 1880s, he, through all his bacterial disease dabbling, was of the mind that TB was not, as was thought at the time, an inherited disease. Are some people more susceptible to it? Compromised immune systems, comorbidities, the very young, the very elderly, whatnot? Well, sure, but this wasn't a faulty gene issue or whatever to his reasoning. He suspected this was a germ situation, and yeah, because think about it. Rampant disease, and so did all these people have faulty genes? What kind of massive coincidence that would be? He was right, of course, as we now know. Cool factoid here, TB has been around, that is, the bacteria that causes it, forever. And I'll stick an article in show notes for you that talks about this, and the title says it all. Mycobacterium tuberculosis complex DNA from an extinct bison dated 17,000 years before the present. Because yes, animals can get it too. 17,000 years, holy cow. Holy bison. And there's more. They found it in mummies and remains from Neolithic times. You get the picture. This isn't news. And others have been making discoveries around TB and making suppositions about the transmission and causes, and also what the hell to do to help these people. Sanatoriums were where the infected would be isolated, and they were popping up, getting the infected out into the fresh air as much as possible was trending, but none of this whole, hey, this is a disease situation that people are spreading to each other, that hadn't really gotten traction because they hadn't isolated it like Fran Koch. He publishes his findings about a bacteria being a source in 1882 and expanded upon his findings later in an 1884 booklet and named the bacteria. Now, of course, the initial reaction was skeptical, and okay, the answer to that is science. You start trying to replicate his findings independently, blah, blah, blah. But that takes a little while, and it did indeed take a little while longer to get to us across the pond. So, as far as America goes, quote, during the 1700s, this highly contagious disease infected large numbers of people and killed as many as 66% of its victims within 5 years of diagnosis. It was especially prevalent in overcrowded conditions where there was malnutrition, and it killed as many as a quarter of those living in poorer conditions. Also, quote, consumption was probably the most common killer of American colonial adults and accounted for more than 25% of deaths in New York City between 1810 and 1815. And regarding the country broadly, throughout the 1800s, TB was the cause of death for, on average, 1 in 7 Americans. Here's the thing, though. After 1815, there's this weird drop-off, and it's not known specifically why, but the prevailing ideas make sense to me. One, improved socioeconomics that in turn led to better living conditions, such as better nutrition. And two, the whole thing of getting the infected the hell out of there, into hospitals and sanatoriums, and just out, into wide open spaces, like I mentioned, to resorts or whatnot out in the boonies, in the mountains, or the deserts. I mean, if you look back, you can find quarantine, not necessarily called that, maybe exile. I don't know the exact words used, but you can find it even in the Bible. I mean, way back, it's documented that people understood you should, well, lepers, for one example, people understood that you should separate those with unusual behavior, let's call it, because they might interpret sickness as a behavior. You separate them because you don't want it to spread. They got that concept.
But I don't know about biblical. I don't know if science was involved in the biblical version of that. I think that was more just like, that dude's kind of icky. We should leave him alone.
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, they would put, there's a book, actually, that I read in college. It was assigned, but I enjoyed it. It's called The Red Tent, and part of it talks about how in biblical times, they would even separate the women who were on their periods, and they'd go to the red tents on the kind of outskirts of the encampment, village, whatever. And you know what? If something bleeds for 7 days and doesn't die, I'd be a little apprehensive myself. I mean, I get it. It's weird nowadays, but I kind of, yeah, you're right. The mentality totally wasn't science.
It's good to know, though, that like how many millions of years now has the world been there? And we still, men still don't have a full grasp of what's going on down there.
Well, wait, with us or with yourselves? Both?
Well, why not both, but mostly you? I surprise myself every day.
Every day, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it doesn't help that there's a lot of women out there that they expect men to somehow have divine this knowledge. God knows sex ed in high schools didn't do anything.
As somebody who grew up in a Catholic school system, I didn't even know I had a penis till I was like 18. Like, the education there is far, far worse.
We just won't talk about it and it'll go away. That's religion.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I'm coming in here with any weird territory.
No. We've rated the podcast explicit, so I mean we've already dropped the cock bomb, so may as well just continue it.
Yeah, I keep wanting to like is this gonna ruin the whole recording process to take like a 2 minute aside?
No.
Okay. My whole experience, like in my early 20s to like 25. I was specifically doing improv comedy and stand-up comedy.
Get out!
And so, like, from that background, like, when somebody gets going into their rhythm, which it sounds like you are, I just feel very hesitant to speak up at all because I don't want to, like, distract myself. I feel like this is all knowledge I need to know. There were a bunch of things I didn't know if it would have been out of place to jump in. I'm still trying to feel that out. I don't want to like interrupt it when you really seem to be going through a lot of like very necessary information. So if that's fine, I will continue to do that because
oh no, I welcome sarcasm and flippance and yeah, go for it. You're fine and you're gonna have plenty of material. This is just the gotta know stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The context stuff. So that's why we make it an hour long. I could have just done the story, you know what I'm saying, and made it like 20 minutes. But I feel like when I was going through it, knowing this stuff and knowing basically the lesson's going to be they should have known better and they probably did know better. And they still just do some things that are beyond the pale. Believe me. It's
yeah, when you bring up sanatoriums, I have to point out that like for an institution designed to take care of people, historically, they've done an awful job of taking care of people.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Who located that?
I don't. It's, oh, and for everybody listening, different than asylums. Also, for some reason, because I looked into this, the etymology of this, for some reason, sanitarium and sanatorium are interchangeable, but because I don't know if you listened to it, but the episode on the invention of cornflakes, sanitarium, like weight loss, health, but then they get interchanged. And I mean, in academic articles that I've read, so I don't get it.
Do allow me. Although in the past the two words seemed to be differentiated based upon care for those with physical issues versus those with real or presumed mental issues, according to the grammarist, the roots of the words indicate that they are, in fact, more like synonyms. Quote, the word sanatorium is derived from the late Latin word sanatorius, which means health-giving. The word sanitarium is derived from the Latin word sanatos, which means health. Did that clear things up? I have no idea. Carry on.
But you're right. Their efficacy is garbage, so I don't know how they were so popular for so long. But hope springs eternal. So, okay, there was a drop-off in tuberculosis deaths, not a huge amount, but enough to notice. And sure, these people being isolated at these sanitariums certainly helped. Problem with this is, over the years, the trend of thinking this was an inherited thing started getting thrown around again, because you can survive it. Those with more robust immune systems, probably those who had been exposed before, could only have a touch of it and bounce back over the course of months. I mean, it was bad, but not total Walking Dead bad. So there were enough instances of people, you know, talking about efficacy. This is majorly into anecdotal territory. Like, well, so-and-so's Aunt Gladys went to the one in wherever, and she came back great. Well, yeah, but then, like with the invention of cornflakes saying, plenty of people became anorexic and malnourished and anemic, and it was awful. But you don't hear those stories like today. You only hear the worst and the best. So this is why Koch's work, even though it was getting proven gradually by others over in Europe, was slow to get traction in America. And we're just slow in general. Okay, quote, but American doctors in the 18th century still did not believe it was contagious. Since it had a higher prevalence in more disadvantaged people, some physicians associated consumption with hereditary traits. Yeah, because of course if you're poor, that means something is inherently wrong with you. I hate people. I hate them.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, many physicians in America did believe, the majority of them in fact, and namely, Dr. Edward L. Trudeau, who was, quote, the first American to validate Koch's findings, though the larger American medical community did not accept TB as contagious for several more years. But again, we're only talking about a handful of years, not up to the point of our story. By the time of our story, the majority accepted it. But the ones who were really on top of things, they rejected the hereditary thing. They agreed it was a disease. So there you go. Trudeau's interest stemmed from the fact that he'd actually had TB and survived. In 1884, he opens America's first sanitarium at Saranac Lake, New York. Why am I bringing this up? Because this was in the Northeast and it made news. People knew about this. People were aware, especially in the aforementioned Northeast. Did they know for sure that this was a droplet transmission thing? No, nobody did. It wasn't definitively proven yet, but the concept was there that this was a person-to-person issue, clearly. Northeast, though. Have I mentioned the Northeast? Again, the Northeast. You know, right there next to New England. And speaking of, I now take you to New England, Exeter, Rhode Island, March of 1892, the 17th, in fact. And I think you'll find what I'm about to tell you is happening way too recently in the past for your liking. Farmer George Brown has been approached by some townspeople who had a suggestion for him regarding his troubles. You see, George's household had been hit hard by the old consumption. In December of 1883, his wife Mary died of it. 6 months later, 20-year-old daughter Olive dies of it. Things seemed okay for a while, but then 19-year-old daughter Mercy, great name, comes down with it in 1891, suffers for a year, dies in the winter of 1892, and oh, by the way, 24-year-old brother Edwin had contracted it before Mercy, but his has been more of a slow roll. He's been ill for about 2 years, and he's close to death by the time Mercy dies. George had even sent him off to Colorado to one of those consumption spas I mentioned for about 18 months, and they were ultimately like, go home and die, we got nothing.
Okay.
And what did the people suggest? That this was not, in fact, a disease, nor was this something hereditary. That George should be aware this was the work of vampires slowly killing Edwin. That those vampires were his dead family. That they dig up said dead family, make sure they were still there, possibly remove their organs and burn them, then boil the ashes in water and give it to Edwin. It's probably your wife, since she got sick first, but just in case, let's do it upright. After all, we've got all these shovels. And why? Well, quote, a vampire hysteria had gripped the New England town. Exeter residents believed that Edwin's mother or one of his sisters may be undead, caught between heaven and hell, and sucking the life out of him from beyond the grave, which meant the cure could rest with their bodies. Completely logical. And what did George say? Okay.
Oh my God, I'm sorry, I was laughing so hard. What is wrong with New England?
I don't know.
Like, anytime anything happens, they're just like, if it's not witches, it's gotta be vampires. Like, what is wrong?
Oh, yeah. Way to go. Way to go, New England.
Their train of thought is astounding to me. Especially, you said it was, what, 1892?
Uh-huh.
How do you go from, something's happening, it's gotta be vampires.
It's gotta be, and I wanted to take a moment to repeat some of the stuff we had by this point. Cameras, light bulbs, engines, rudimentary cars, electric motors, batteries, phonographs, the telephone, and knowledge that this was a disease. Maybe most importantly, there was, in fact, that popular treatment center in New York. Hell, they'd sent the Sun to one out west. And the townspeople were scared that they would get it. How would they get it if this was a Brown family thing? Their genetics or their relatives killing other relatives. But vampires.
It wasn't just like one instance, too. You said vampire hysteria, like this was sweeping the nation.
Oh,
what is wrong with them?
Oh, you're taking the words out of my mouth. That is, yeah. I mean, oh, yeah. Did all of this come out of the blue? Oh, but no. So let's leave the Browns buried for a few minutes longer and jump around in time for a bit. As with many things in America, there are traces of, or outright identical, traditions and whatnot that come along with immigration from across the pond. Quote, 18th century European peasants believed that the appearance of the vampire in the grave, such as a bloated chest, long fingernails, and blood draining from the mouth, meant that the vampire was draining life from the living. American vampire folk beliefs, which were particularly strong in 19th century New England, contained some European features. The New England folklore is consistent in its incorporation of tuberculosis and examination of the body of the vampire for putative signs of life. Now, we are not going to go through the process of decomp, but I assure you, if you catch a corpse soon enough, there will be bloatage and seepage, sometimes movement, sometimes moans and groans, and the hair and nails growing after death is, that whole thing is an old wives' tale. It's just the skin retracting that gives the illusion. Is it freaky? Yes. Is it weird? Not really. One of my sources sums this whole superstition up nicely, saying, quote, because the dead were supposed to feed upon the living, and so long as the dead body in the grave remained undecomposed, either wholly or in part, the surviving members of the family must continue to furnish substance on which the dead body could feed. Now, here's where we get to your astute point. You all may be wondering, where does the panic verbiage come from? Why does this one incident mean a panic? Definitely not just one, not by a long shot. According to author Diana Ross McCain, a historian specializing in New England, quote, there were 18 documented instances of the exhumation of family members in suspected vampire cases throughout New England in the 18th and 19th century.
My God, 18. Oh my God, I love you so much, New England.
Another one of my sources only located 12, oh, just 12, documenting vampire-related exhumations in the late 1700s to the late 1800s in New England, saying 11 of those accounts very specifically mention consumption as the cause of death of the supposed vampires. Oh, and by the way, it was the newspapers using the word vampires. The people involved weren't calling them that, even though, again, this came from Europe where the word vampire, vampirism was used. So whatever, I don't know. Just a little throwing that in there. Let me regale you with a handful, and we'll speedrun this. Around 1790, Vermont, the Spalding family, 6 of 11 of the children had died from TB, and lucky number 7 came down with it. The dad dug up the most recently departed son, burned his vital organs. 1793, Manchester, Vermont. Rachel Harris Burton. She died 3 years prior, but her husband gave it a go anyhow. Had her dug up to try to save his second wife, who had TB. No joy. I mean, after 3 years, that's bones. And second wife dies later that year. 1796, Cumberland, Rhode Island. Abigail Staples dies of TB. Later, her sister starts having fever dreams and called out Abigail's name during one of them. Oh, so that must mean Abigail's spirit is around, of course. So she's exhumed. Doesn't say what they did, but does say it's documented that while the town council gave permission for the father to dig her up, it was, quote, against their better conscience. Then why'd you do it? Huh. 1799, Exeter, Rhode Island. Sarah Tillinghast. By the point they exhumed her, 5 of the 14 Tillinghast children had died of TB, and now another was on the way out, and also her mother. They dug up the whole lot of them. All 6. Thing was, Sarah was supposedly the least decomposed, even though she died first. I'm calling bullshit. And supposedly her heart had fresh blood in it and her eyes were wide open. Not a chance on the first, but I'll accept the latter, that her eyes were open. I'll accept that. They burn her heart out front of the family home.
Good Lord.
New Ipswich, New Hampshire. Unknown name. A physician documented in a medical journal article about a man who was exhumed by a family who'd been passing around TB and dying, how they do the routine of burning organs and using the ashes as remedy. 1817, South Woodstock, Vermont. Here's a rare situation involving somebody well-to-do. Dartmouth student Frederick Ransom, who dies of TB. Somehow his father got conned, and he has Freddie exhumed, his heart cut out, and burned at a local blacksmith forge. Freddie's brother Daniel, who actually lived past 80 years old, later wrote that it of course didn't work, and TB not only took Freddie, but their mother, sister, and 2 other brothers.
Oh my God. I know these are horrifying things that are happening to people and their families, but I don't know if it's the rapid fire and the variety in which they dealt with the vampires, but this is, I don't think I've laughed so hard in so long. I feel horrible. This is probably the most disrespectful thing I've ever done. But I can't help it. They put him in the blacksmith forge.
Can you imagine that guy? You want me to do what? And the mess? I'm also thinking of the mess. But I'm gruesome.
And it's like, oh yeah, all they have to do is just say, I don't know, man. Do you want to find out that we're wrong about vampires? I don't want to be that guy. Put him in the forge.
I can't. And... oh, you don't. Are you muting yourself when you're laughing? You can laugh your head off. Don't worry about it. I can always.
No, I have a very quiet laugh that kind of builds and then it gets one big loud ha. So I'm trying to get close enough to pick it up because I was just giggling like a thing that giggles. I'm sorry. I was enjoying it so much. I got nothing.
Okay. Now I'm glad. Listen, I'm so glad you were entertained. I was really worried you were going to be bored.
Yeah, even if this doesn't go well and you get nothing, I'm going to enjoy the fact that this was well worth setting aside time to hear this story.
Oh, good, good. 1827, Foster, Rhode Island, Nancy Young. She dies, sister starts dying soon after, then other siblings start going downhill as well. Dad says to family and neighbors, let's dig her up and burn her, and quote, inhale the smoke from the burning remains. And 5 more kids die.
Oh, God.
1860s, Boston, Massachusetts, unknown name, but part of a family riddled with TB, documented by a physician with the State Board of Health. They dig up, burn, eat the ashes. Yeah. Rhode Island, sometime in the mid to late 1800s, Bristow Congdon, and he's found in both the 1820 and 1840 editions of the federal census. Not much more known about him, though. He and two of his children die of TB, and while it's not clear who did this, documentation says, quote, the body of one of the children was exhumed, and the vital parts were burned in obedience to the dicta of this shallow and disgusting superstition. So I include that one to say, don't be under the impression that this was a, how to put it, like, okay, I'm in Tennessee. There are some customs and traditions out in Appalachia that I'm not the type of person to turn my nose up at stuff like that. Not at all. But there's most likely traditions, some I've heard about, that I kind of side-eye. And yeah, some of it's medical stuff. I actually had an acquaintance who tried going out there or did a rotation out there. I can't remember. Just in rural areas. And not so much that what they were doing was bad, but being like, no, there's something called insulin and it will vastly improve your life. Things like that. Or this is a heart pill that will just change your life. You're going to feel so much better. And they're just tough to convince. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to give the impression that this is like that. This is not about perhaps a lack of education or exposure. This is unreal, and people are saying so. 1810, rural New Hampshire, Annie Dennett, age 21, dies of TB. A traveling minister wrote about how he attended her exhumation, which was done for the purpose of saving her father's life, also infected. But unfortunately, by the time it was done, the minister reports that there were just bones, so no organs to burn. 1854, Norwich, Connecticut, a local newspaper reports that in 1846, Horace Griswold had died, and later two of his sons did as well. Then just before this article was published, a third son died, so Horace and the elder two sons were exhumed and burned. Honorable mention, and there's a reason I bring this up. I think you'll get a kick out of it. You may hear of one to do with a girl named Nellie Vaughn, because I did. She came up in when you first give a cursory Google of the Mercy Brown incident, Nellie Vaughn pops up as one of them, but they're wrong. And the Nellie Vaughn incident happened in Rhode Island in 1889. Appears a similar routine of unearthing and whatnot happened. But American folklore expert Michael Bell, who I'm going to reference more as we go, he has found no evidence to show she was exhumed for vampire reasons. Rather, he thinks this is a case of her story and Mercy's story getting intertwined. Though he does note that Nellie's headstone is spooktastic because it reads, I am waiting and watching for you.
Oh, wonderful.
I know that means like waiting for you on the other side at Heaven's Gate, but for fuck's sake. This last one for me is the creepiest. In 1990, in Griswold, Connecticut, there's some erosion happening in a certain area of land, and a handful of kids basically trip over some bones and caskets, which, man, oh man, I know it might make me weird, and I would have been somewhat freaked out, but mostly I'd have been kind of fascinated.
You said 1990.
Right.
As in 31 years ago, 1990.
Well, they find the stuff. This is when they find.
That's right. But still, I didn't expect an abrupt jump from the 1800s where I could give them the vampire thing to the 1990s.
Oh, no. No, these children are not out in the woods vampiring somebody. No. They dig them up. And then the kids dug them up and got out the barbecue and burn the... No. We're clear. We're clear in this respect.
You can't put it past kids.
True. Anthropologists and archaeologists come out. It's an old cemetery, family burial spot. Turns out from records, it was the Walton family. It's circa 1750s, and they lived on this land. Over a year's time, 29 separate individuals are excavated. Everything looks normal. They show signs of hard lives of physical labor based upon the condition of the bones. This tracks with their lifestyle. And then there's JB. He's in a stone-lined grave. Big flat stones are on top as well. And his coffin is painted red. He was apparently 55 when he died, as scratched into the coffin lid is JB55. Evaluation of his bones indicate he definitely had a pulmonary illness, but it's pointed out in one of my sources that regardless of if it was TB or not, The rib lesions indicate he'd likely have been practically coughing up his lungs, so those around him likely would have thought it was consumption.
Poor people.
Poor JB. Did they dig him up and burn his organs? I don't know. What we do know is that they did something to his spine and ribs because those bones were found in, quote, disarray. Another source indicating that the vertebrae were basically smashed, and whomever did this also disarticulated his femurs and his skull, then placed said skull and femurs in the crossbones position. You know, all yo-ho-ho pirate-like. What the hell?
Oh my God.
Resident Connecticut State archaeologist Nick Bellatoni was a bit flummoxed. This was a new jam for... Was a bit flummoxed. This was a new one for him. And then one of his colleagues was like, nah, you hadn't heard of the Jewett City vampires? Because apparently in 18... I know, this is just common knowledge. Apparently in 1854, in nearby Jewett City, quote, townspeople had exhumed several corpses suspected to be vampires that were rising from their graves to kill the living. And there's newspaper accounts of this, how the Ray family dug up two of the departed sons in hopes of helping son number three and, quote, burned them right there in the graveyard. I mean, it just goes on and on. So, Mercy Brown. They dig her up, hoist out the coffin, but, quote, when the lid was lifted off of Mercy's coffin, her body was found on her side. Her face appeared flush, and there was blood in her heart and in her veins. No, it's goopy dark stuff. I assure y'all, it does not resemble thin red blood that you know and hate. It ain't moving. It ain't circulating. She's not getting up and cruising around and coughing on you and then climbing back in for Betty Bye. And if she's a spirit doing this, I submit, what significance does blood have? What significance is it that she's not a pile of bones? Why would a spirit need an intact body with blood if they aren't getting out and moving around? Huh. Now, if you look this story up, the story of Mercy, a lot of places will make excuses for the people of this period by being like, oh, not a lot was known about TB at the time, and I hope I've shown you that this is bullshit. And oh, well, even so, not all doctors knew about it. Well, let me introduce you to one who did. The local Exeter physician and medical examiner, Dr. Harold Metcalf, who, quote, had raised his objection to the entire affair and assured everyone that the lack of decomposition of Mercy's body was perfectly consistent with the fact that she had been dead for less than 2 months. Also, it was winter in New England, and also, it's reported that the ground had been too hard when she died in January to get a good dig going. And also, the third, for the majority of her postmortem life, she had been kept above ground. The family had a crypt where she was stashed. Point is, she had been exposed to frigid temperatures and therefore was even more well-preserved than if she'd been in the ground the whole time, where there's more protection from the cold air and has some natural heat. The flushed cheeks? We call that freezer burn. The blood? Well, yeah, of course there's some present because it's not like she had been embalmed and flushed out. And you may think, well, these were country folk and whatever. No. Exeter wasn't big city posh, but this was not super duper rural. And boy howdy, did the newspaper, the Providence Journal, not pull any punches in their Saturday, March 19th edition. Headline, bodies of dead relatives taken from their graves, testing a horrible superstition in the town of Exeter. Says the aforementioned Michael Bell in his book, Food for the Dead, on the trail of New England's vampires, quote, with this front page headline, the Journal introduced the Brown family to the world. The melodrama didn't surprise me, nor was I surprised after reading the article following my interview with a Brown family descendant that the newspaper questioned the cultural refinement of those who exhumed the bodies. But I was taken aback by the harshness of the tone. I'm not at all. But to further elaborate on what he meant by harsh tone, here's a bit of what the article concluded. The shocking case of exhumation in one of the border towns of this state is only a rather more unusual, striking illustration of a truth which cannot be denied, that the amount of ignorance and superstition to be found in some corners of New England is more than surprising to one who comes into contact with it for the first time. There are considerable elements of rural population in this part of the country upon which the forces of education and civilization have made scarcely any impression. I mean, damn.
So glad somebody knew it. I'm so glad somebody recognized it back then.
Oh, agreed. Agreed. It makes me feel somewhat better about this story. Still can't believe it happened in this recent past, but I agree. Still thankful that there were people out there who were calling this out.
Voice of reason.
Yes. Because they sure as hell weren't listening to the doctors, so maybe public pressure. And thank God, I think that made a difference, honestly, by the end. Spoiler, Mercy Brown is nicknamed America's Last Vampire. And while for his book, part of Bell's research involved talking to a descendant of the Brown family, like I mentioned, what I've told you and will continue to tell you with regards to the Mercy Brown incident comes from the newspaper account, which appears to be thoroughly researched. It tracks with the family story that was told to Bell for the most part, but y'all know how stories passed down in families can be. Some things get exaggerated, some things get toned down. One thing, though, the article didn't mention Mercy turning over in her grave, but I don't doubt that there's an element of truth to that. I presume they buried her flat on her back with her arms crossed over her chest, and I bet money that between natural corpsey movement when rigor let loose and decomp started, and then the jostling of the casket when she's put into the crypt, the jostling of the casket when she's finally buried, now the jostling of the casket when she's raised, that she probably moved a little. The newspaper also makes no mention of Edwin ingesting Mercy's ashes, but again, this is part of the shtick. So if you told me that he actually did, I'm not surprised, because all my other sources mention that he drank her ashes mixed in tea or hot water. I can't. Can you imagine somebody coming to your bedside and being like, I know that you're coughing up your last breaths and you're not eating or drinking, but we're going to need you to get this down. Well, what is it? Are those herbs floating in that tea? No, that's your sister. How does this article have all this detail? Well, they did interviews with townsfolk, as well as Dr. Metcalf, whom this group had called to the event, and he went hoping to talk them out of it. And if not, make sure everything was, I guess, not crazy. Well, crazier?
Well, you can only do so much.
Exactly, exactly. But the biggest factor, a local court, I can't believe this either. This blew my mind. The biggest factor, a local correspondent for the Providence Journal, who is assigned to the Exeter beat, happened to be in the area at the time, covering some hot stories about cow tipping. I don't know, but what I do know is the kid recognized a gold mine when he heard it, and he is actually at the exhumation. And I hope he got a raise and a promotion, because check out the date. This article was Sunday the 19th, or Saturday the 19th. And the exhumation party went down on the 17th. I mean, he was on it. great kid. This kid deserves all the claps on the back. Let me also point out, there was a local Exeter newspaper, so they got information from that as well. And they had actually reported on Edwin being sick and going out to Colorado Springs. This was a town of less than 1,000 people at the time. And so it was basically, here's what's going on. Tragedy has really hit this family. Please send your well wishes and prayers to the Browns. As you can imagine, they also reported on the exhumation. And part of what they said was, quote, the husband and father of the deceased ones has, from the first, disclaimed any faith at all in the vampire theory. But he did it. I mean, George was tired, y'all. George was real, real, real tired. He was about to be the last of his family. He knew it. The man was tired. But I tell you, I still don't know that I would have said yes to my neighbors digging up my wife and daughters. I've never been in that situation, so I can't 100% say for sure. But I've never been one to do something simply to satisfy others. So I probably wouldn't do this.
So that is, okay, so you did say he didn't believe an ounce of it, and yet he still drank the tea?
Well, yeah, George the dad you know what? You bring up a good point. It only talked about the sick son drinking the tea, but I wonder if they had the dad drink it too, because he had yet to fall ill, and maybe they thought, that's a good question. I didn't see that mentioned, but I don't doubt it.
I mean, if you have a whole batch of it, you're not really going to get a second batch. You might as well. I mean, when in Rome.
Oh, I'd be like, mix mine with whiskey. That's the only way you're getting this down me. Or give me a bunch of whiskey before and just, yeah. It is noted, however, I'll give him this. While George did give his permission, he declined to be present when it was done. The Providence News story goes on to say that Dr. Metcalf had been called upon to attend to Mercy at the end of her life. He tells George there's nothing he can do, because there wasn't. And Metcalf hears nothing about the Browns for about a year until George again contacts him and says, I think my son is dying of the same thing, and by the way, my neighbors think if he eats part of my daughter, it'll clear up.
I'm enjoying this. This is delightful.
I'm so glad. So, you know, I kind of fudged a little bit earlier when I made it sound like he immediately was like, all right. But George didn't say yes right away, but he still said yes. Metcalf gets out there pretty fast and, quote, found four men who had unearthed the remains of Mrs. Brown. Some of the muscles and flesh still existed in a mummified state, but there were no signs of blood in the heart. The body of the first daughter, Olive, was then taken out of the grave, but only a skeleton with a thick growth of hair remained. All right, so it goes on to say, then they get Mercy out, I told you about her reported condition, and they proceed to cut her open and remove her heart and liver. They slice open the liver, no blood, makes sense, the liver is really dense. But when they, because their whole jam is that it be, I guess, flowing to a degree, or liquid to a degree, so you're not going to get that with a liver, with a dried out, nasty liver. But when they cut open the heart, they do find some sludgy blood, and this also makes sense because their hearts are hollow, and when they stop pumping, there is residual blood left in them. Apparently, the lungs were also cut open because it says, quote, the lungs show diffuse tuberculosis germs. See, germs, they use the term, and knowledge that germs cause TB. And my interpretation of this is that Dr. Metcalf noted that scarring we talked about, those lesions, and being able to spot those in a decomposing corpse, not being lit in a room indoors at a proper autopsy, tells me that she had it something awful. So they burn the heart and the liver on a little fire atop a nearby rock, not the lungs, which were clearly what was infected. That would make too much sense. And quote, Edwin was said to have drunk the ashes in water shortly thereafter. Okay. Look, would you ingest, even if you knew this might work, let's just play devil's advocate. If you thought, if they said there's a 50-50 chance still, would you ingest any part of the remains of a deathly ill person? I mean, I wouldn't.
How well done are we talking? Like, to a crisp? Like, 25-minute steak on the grill? Because, I mean, that burns the germs off, right?
Well, first of all, somebody who puts a steak on the grill for 25 minutes should be shot. No, let's say medium rare. Well, I don't know. To me, it's going to be the most, after all that time, like, God, a gummy bear. Like, the consistency's going to be bad. Oh, it's going to be bad. How long can TB bacteria survive without a living host? I mean, bacteria thrive on dead stuff, but I'm specifically talking about TB. Did I look that up? Of course I did. Have y'all met me? Quote, the transfer and handling of a corpse expels air from the lungs of the diseased, and this aerosolizes the bacilli. It is for this reason that personal protective equipment and workspace precautions such as ultraviolet germicidal irradiation is a necessity. I'd also add, from any sputum or other fluids, gotta watch that. And further, quote, results demonstrated, from another study that is, results demonstrated that samples tested positive prior to embalming 36 days after death. After 3 weeks post-embalming, none tested positive. And remember, right now, we're talking about unembalmed, because they didn't, I mean, they did, but not these folk. Because they, again, not super duper rural, but they are out of ways, and there wasn't like an embalming guy on hand. They did have that medical examiner though, but clearly this wasn't something that he was tasked with doing. So a little over a month, if they weren't already infected, they were fine. But it doesn't matter regarding Edwin ingesting the ashes since he gone. He's on borrowed time. And sure enough, Edwin dies in May. Now pop quiz, everybody. And you, if you want to answer, I'm putting you on the spot. But pop quiz, why didn't George get sick?
Huh. I have no idea, to be totally honest. Did he drink the tea? He did not drink the tea in this scenario.
He drank the tea and it worked. No, he, I would bet money, had latent TB. There is no way he did not contract it. Absolutely no way. Because you got what? Edwin, sister, Mercy, wife. That's five people living in a small home. Four out of the five are dead. he had to have it. He had to have gotten a touch of it and recovered. But I bet money he had latent TB.
Yeah, they might have built him tougher back then.
Oh, he was a good stock. I think, I don't remember off the top of my head. I say when he died at the end, but I can't remember. But he lived quite a long time.
He had a good stock. Oh, my good Lord.
So this was beyond the pale, clearly. And again, don't just mean by today's standards. People were calling him out. A lot of places were having none of it. The folks back then were inundated with woo like this. There were these so-called healers who would travel around and do the snake oil thing, the tonics and the liniments, and prey on the desperate. They were pretty rampant for a while. And quoting from Bell again, they set up shops in towns, advertised in local newspapers and broadsides. Most of their ads included supposed testimonies from satisfied customers and moved on when business dried up or, not infrequently, were run out of town by officials or dissatisfied clients. Bell goes on to say, but New England never warmed to itinerant healers, as a scholar of New England culture noted. Quote within a quote here, New Englanders gathered to elect magistrates, and platform healers, Indian doctors, and herbalists may have been reduced to soliciting door-to-door and tavern-to-tavern in an informal network far removed from public acceptance and recognition. Which kind of surprised me, that people in a position to were calling out the woo. And good on them, because they were certainly fighting an uphill battle in the 1800s in general, as we have covered to a startling degree on the podcast. So way to go, New England. Way to go in that respect. I mean, in my rundown of other cases earlier, I mentioned how newspapers were calling people out and town councils documented disapproval way before the time of the Mercy story. On the other hand, another one of my sources points out, it's documented that sometimes this was more than just an intimate family affair with maybe some friends and or neighbors. Many times, it was a legit event with people who were in high town positions participating. There were balloon animals, brought out ponies for the kids. No. But what if? Quote, sometimes town fathers voted on the matter, or medical doctors and clergymen gave their blessings or even pitched in. In Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Vermont, they frequently burned the dead person's heart, sometimes inhaling the smoke as a cure. Often these rituals were clandestine, lantern-lit affairs. But, particularly in Vermont, they could be quite public, even festive. One vampire heart was reportedly torched on the Woodstock, Vermont town green in 1830. In Manchester, hundreds of people flocked to a 1793 heart-burning ceremony at, again, here we go, a blacksmith's forge. And this reminds me of people going to hangings and beheadings. They were bored. They were so bored.
I mean, that's fair. You telling me we're about to burn a heart for some fun. What else am I going to do in 1890?
I go back and forth thinking if I would show up. Part of me thinks I would. There's a big part of me that thinks I would. I wouldn't go to a hanging or a beheading. I know that about myself, but this is kind of interesting.
Yeah, especially at the festive Vermont ones. What if you met your future wife or husband? You could say, oh, I met it at the vampire heart burning. That's a story that's generational. That'll last forever. Do you have a date for the vampire heart burning?
That's it, exactly. And there's something in there with, you know, heart, love, all that. They met over the frying heart. Oh, God. But again, I have to stress, doctors were not dropping the ball on this. Quote, their doctors talked to them about catching it from other people and about family tendencies. And one of my sources goes on to talk about how if it was known that you had the disease, there's documentation of being fired from jobs so it wouldn't spread around the workplace. And another example given was that barbers would refuse service because they didn't want to risk catching it. So yeah, Brown's neighbors being worried made sense. They were afraid that they and their families might catch it. They understood. I mean, hell, the woo peddlers, they understood and they were taking advantage of it, emphasizing how the medical community had yet to come up with a cure for TB. Well, and you know what? Then you do it if you know so much, you jerks. Circling back to the Browns again. This did not stay local. After the Journal's article came out, it catches the attention of a prominent anthropologist who goes out there to, quote, probe the barbaric superstition. His write-up is published in the well-respected American Anthropologist Journal, and quote, his account of New England's vampires made waves throughout the world. Before long, even members of the foreign press were offering various explanations for the phenomenon. a writer for the London Post, declared that whatever forces drove the Yankee vampire, it was an American problem and most certainly not the product of a British folk tradition. Which, nice try, that's cute. No, sorry. And this one got me. A Boston Daily Globe writer said, quote, "Perhaps the frequent intermarriage of families in these backcountry districts may partially account for some of their characteristics." And look, just because some people meet their beloveds at a family reunion and get introduced to each other by Uncle Daddy, look, you're judging. You're judging. But there you go. There's some matchmaking going on. I'm going to close out with a fun tidbit, and it's something that I asked Tiff not to mention in her Dracula episode if she came across it so that I could mention it here. Around the time of the Mercy Brown incident, a theater company from London was touring the United States, and the story caught the eye of the company's stage manager, who also happened to be an aspiring writer, and his name was Bram Stoker. His claim to fame, Dracula, was published in 1897, and it features a young girl named Lucy. By the way, Mercy was often called by her middle name, Lena, who is bitten by Dracula and is ultimately exhumed by concerned citizens and friends and a doctor who is also present at the scene. Now, is this just a fun rumor trying to connect the two? That's what I thought. Except for the fact that after Stoker's death, newspaper clippings about Miss Mercy Lena Brown were found amongst his files. So, what of tuberculosis? Though theorized by multiple scientists that the key to this was airborne transmission, it wasn't until the mid-20th century that it was conclusively shown that it was indeed passed around by the inhalation of contaminated air droplets. And what of George Brown? I'll quote Bell here again. "The crucial event in that drama was George Brown choosing a course of action. I viewed his decision in relation to what he surely must have felt. Uncertainty, fear, desperation, community, hope, resolution, and healing." And I am happy to say that even though he faced more heartbreak than anyone should ever have to, and might have been forced to drink his daughter's ashes, we don't know, speculation, he did live a very long life, and he passed away, get this, in 1922.
What?
Long life, yes. I could not believe it.
It's that full stock of his.
And what of the panic? There's no widespread or well-circulated vampire exhumations after Mercy's. Either people kept it really under wraps, or the humiliation got them. Or who knows what. My strong suspicion is the humiliation. But the regularity, at least, had come to a close. And I guess my take-home message for today, y'all just go on and assume whatever funky is going around, just assume it is in the air until you know otherwise. And if you do happen to get sick, it's not your dead sister's fault. And that is your story of the American Vampire Panic and Mercy Brown, America's Last Vampire. Comments, questions, concerns?
No, I'm accepting that if there is a Christian hell, I'm definitely burning in it for how hard I laughed at the terrible misfortunes of a lot of New England families today. That was wild.
I knew of vampire, all this vampire stuff in Europe. Had no idea about this.
Yeah, I feel like the witches are the prominent story. They didn't touch on vampires enough when, at least when I was growing up, I had no idea.
I came upon it. I feel like I heard a podcast on it years ago. That there's something scratching the back of my brain. I feel like I did. But I stumbled upon it when I was helping Tiff look for Bram Stoker stuff. And like I say, he's inadvertently a part of this story because he apparently kept everything. He hoarded notes and, you know, clearly newspaper articles and early drafts and stuff like that. And stuff about this kid was in it. All right. Are we done?
This was a very interesting experience. I feel like I could have I'm sorry if I didn't contribute enough.
No, you did fine.
I can't stress that I went for a wild ride there from start to finish, and my mouth hurts because just when you think Blacksmith Forge is the peak, we've hit the ceiling. The next batch of people, it's like as time progressed, they considered like, well, this didn't work. We got to up the ante here. We got to move his spine somewhere else as a goof.
Poor old JB.
I mean, I walked out thinking that the most important thing I'm probably going to learn today is that not all vampires are apparently handsome, but I learned so much more than that.
It's insane. And you're in New England, right? Is your state? I don't know. I don't think. No, it's not technically.
No, and I'm more in the lower central part of it. So we're basically in that part they call Pennsylvania.
Aha. Okay.
So a lot of the stuff you had to say about Appalachia, there's a lot of parts like that out here.
Yeah, I had said in one episode we were talking about country folk, and I differentiated between southern and country, and I might have actually said Pennsylvania, but I was like, you can have country virtually anywhere. Country's just a different beast. It's not exclusively mm-hmm. southern. So yeah, I feel you.
Oh yeah, we got country. We got lots of it.
But again, Exeter at this time was not the sticks. Was it bustling like Providence? No. I just wouldn't consider this what in my mind I think of as just a bunch of simple folk who had no exposure to anything. And, you know, now that I think of it, I had read something, I think, on the Exeter.gov site that talked about this period of time. I want to say they even used the word flourished, as a matter of fact, but I feel like I didn't quote it. I may have gotten distracted and lost my place in my notes. So, okay, editing Nash. If I didn't quote it, have text-to-speech guys say it now, and we can all cheer Nash was right, as we love to do. Otherwise, delete this entire thing.
Hello there. Nash did indeed leave it out. It was right there in her notes and she brain farted. Here is what the Exeter Town website says. Quote, Exeter flourished during the 1800s. Farms and villages grew up around the rivers and streams, providing power for textile manufacturing, sawmills, and grist mills. Stores, taverns, schools, a library, churches, and a bank were all established within the town. I wonder why they didn't mention a blacksmith forge.
Hmm?
All right, folks, that is it. I thank my lovely guest, and I thank you for listening, and we'll catch you in the next one. This is where the catchphrase goes.
Oh, is that something for me?
Thanks for listening. As a reminder, you can check out our sources for each of the episodes at our blog, along with any other supplemental things we think you might enjoy. Just head over to youtotallymadethatup.tumblr.com, and in the menu, click on show notes.
We're also on Twitter at YTMTUpodcast and on Instagram at YouTotallyMadeThatUp. You can contact us at any of those places, and you can also email us. That address is YouTotallyMadeThatUp@gmail.com.
We love hearing from you, whether it's ideas for episodes, your own personal or family stories, telling us what we can do better, and telling us what we should keep on doing.
And if you're enjoying the podcast, please consider taking a moment to rate and review on your platform of choice. Or if you know someone who may like our content, send them our way.
We're so grateful for our listeners and would love to add even more people to our wild podcast family.